I'm going to take, since this is the discussion session on these three books, 1984 and the Martian Chronicles and Brave New World, and what perspectives they might provide on love and hope, I'd like to take just a minute or two to think back over them, because I know that some of you are not reading them this week, have read some of these long ago, and have not read others at all. And what I hope we are going to be able to do today is to find some common kind of thing or things in these books that help us to get some perspective on our futures. Not space futures and so on, but the future futures of human beings and the kind of hope that they can have. And I prepared what I'm saying today before I went to the Bible study this morning. How many of you were there? Good number of you. And I think that, as a matter of fact, you may be able to put more perspective on this than I'm able to by the time we're through with the discussion, and I hope we have time for that to happen. Because I thought that the discussion that took place there this morning, particularly about the action of Christianity being in the world and not outside it, is very informative. And there were some categories of things which you might begin to see. One of the things that I was sitting there thinking about, for those of you who remember 1984 at all, is to what extent you might be able to do one of two things in thinking about the book, which is one, to go back and see Winston and Julia now as Adam and Eve, which is a very disturbing thought, or to, on the other hand, to see the ending of the Martian Chronicles, one death and a new life, as something that is a new hope for life, as something that is extremely Christian in its orientation. But we'll get to that, I hope. Amid all the talk of nuclear war and alternatives to our current way of dealing with each other as nations, we've been exploring some books. And unlike some of the other books that are being used this week, these books are not new. That is, there's nothing trendy about the Martian Chronicles, 1984, and Brave New World. Just want to remind you as we get into this discussion that Brave New World was written in 1932, and it describes a society in which biological technology, from clones to happiness drugs, is used to maintain power in a society. 1984, which was written in the 1940s, just after World War II, describes a society in which government-administered hate, war, fear, and brainwashing, and murder are systematically used to maintain power in a society in the atomic age. That is, there have been nuclear explosions there. But not the thermonuclear age that we know now. It's a more limited kind of atomic age in that novel. The Martian Chronicles, which was written about the same time as 1984, describes the migration of people like you and me to Mars, partly to escape atomic war and partly for other purposes. Some people are entrepreneurs, and some people are excited by the adventure, and so on. But then that book looks at the way in which they create a new society on Mars, and the way in which the mission of coming from Earth to Mars is received by a society that is already there. All of those books are still available in the bookstore. For those of you who might want to take a look at some interesting and challenging reading, and of course, will continue to be challenging to you long after the, I hope, long after the discussions that we're having here. However, we're really not looking at these books in the sense that thinking back to the Bible study this morning in John Schramm, our purpose in these books is not to find out whether it came true or not. You know, this is not dead. This is not dead stuff. We are looking at, in the way of trying, we're not trying to figure out whether we're any closer to 1984 or to a brave new world today than we were when the books were written, and or to see whether Ray Bradbury was right about Mars' ability to support life and our ability to travel there. In that case, we know, or we think we know now, based on further experience, that Mars won't support human life by itself, although it does in Ray Bradbury's book. And so we could dismiss the book and say it's, you know, didn't come true. He was wrong. His prediction was wrong. Therefore, the book has no value. On the other hand, we know now, it wasn't maybe at the time Ray Bradbury wrote his book, but today it is conceivable to our minds that human beings could get in a rocket and go to Mars. We haven't had human beings go there now, but we understand the technology well enough to, I think we can imagine that even in our lifetimes, that might actually occur. So we could say, oh, his prediction came true. Well, where would we be? We would have missed, in my judgment, what is the real purpose of this book, as well as the other two, which is to cast some perspective on us, who we are right now, by putting us creatively in a different environment and watching ourselves through the characters in these books interact with what they find. But the perspective, that's the perspective this week, too. It's not what the future will be like or even might be like. You know, are we going to have nuclear catastrophe is not the answer, is not the question. The question is, how can we cope with the world that we find ourselves in? How can we live the politics of hope? And in order to do that, in various ways, around this village, we've been looking at what living means and what politics means and what hope means. In several contexts, and in the sense of our own capacities to cope with threatening and potentially catastrophic futures. And I might add that that this is not the first time in the history of man that we've looked at potentially catastrophic futures. Just to provide another little perspective, if you were living in Europe in a certain part of the Middle Ages when people were dropping dead of the plague around you on a daily basis, you might wonder, too, about how you could live the politics of hope in that environment. And you might look to the church and sometimes find it lacking in the same way that people are looking at that at that kind of question today. What kind of living can we do? What kind of politics, in Walter Stuhr's sense, of actualization of the promise, which I think is one of the neatest ways to think about politics that I've heard since I've been here. What kind of politics is possible now with the threat of catastrophe and sometimes overwhelming us? What kind of expectations are there? What kind of hope is it possible to maintain? And is there, it comes right down flat up front to the question of, is there some hope beyond the hope of getting right with God and, and having the world end and going to heaven or however we variously may think of that? Two of the three books are negative utopias. They show worlds without much expectation. The third one, The Martian Chronicles, actually ends with the extinction of all human life on Earth. And the last section in it, not only is all human life on Earth gone, but it shows the fantastically complicated technology finally grinding to a halt. It lasts after human life is extinct. But the last chapter, which has a very informative title, or it's next to the last, is called There Will Come Soft Rains. And that shows a house, very fantastic, tomorrow's house grinding to a halt after there are no human beings left anymore. But it keeps on running, it keeps on making food, it keeps on cleaning, it keeps on doing all kinds of things until something happens. But all life on Earth is extinct. All Martian life is extinct on Mars. And what has happened at the end of the novel is that, the picnic chapter, is that there's one Earth family, and there may be another one, they don't even know, that in their own rocket that they have hidden from the government back home, they've been able to bring their family to Mars. And in a sense, they see they are all life that is left in the universe as far as anyone knows it. And so one of the questions that is posed there is whether this Mars might be the future, a Garden of Eden, a place for a new opportunity to begin, and what they will do with it. Now, our topic today is Love and Hope in 1984 and Beyond. That title is intended to suggest a flavor of the grand titles of literary criticism. Some people may think it pretentious, and it's deliberately so. If you've inhabited that world at all, and you know how overblown it is in the sense in which it looks at great significance in great literature. More than that, though, it's intended to ask a question. If we look at love in whatever manifestation we can find it in these books, can we find hope there? And about that, I think it's fair to say your guess is about as good as mine, but perhaps together we can find it out, and particularly coming, as you do, informed from another tradition. What I want to do in the next 15 minutes, which will still allow us, I hope, a half hour to talk among ourselves about this and what your perspectives and ours are based on the experience in Holden Village, I want to make some observations based on, I want to reveal what I hope are some insights that I have had as I have looked at these books this week in this context. In the middle of the week, I read a little chapter from the Martian Chronicles called The Watchers. And it is a chapter, just to remind you, in which, it's very short, in which the great atomic war begins on Earth. And a very strange thing happens to these people who are now well established on Mars and who have left Earth behind in many ways. As it says early, this is just a little short chapter, but I'm not going to take the time to read the whole thing. They stood on the porches and tried to believe in the existence of Earth such as they had once tried to believe in the existence of Mars. These are people who have made a transition, presumably. To all intents and purposes, Earth was now dead. They had been away from it for 3 or 4 years. Space was an anesthetic. 70 million miles of space numbed you, put memory to sleep, depopulated Earth, erased the past, and allowed these people here to go on with their work. But now, something was happening. Because of the anticipation of a major atomic explosion and the possible destruction of Earth, suddenly some things come back to you, and it goes like this. We haven't heard from Harry for a long time. He's all right. We should send a message to Mother. She's all right. Is she? Now don't worry. Will she be all right, do you think? The Earth had exploded, or seemed to explode, and at 9 o'clock, right on schedule. And 3 hours later, it was still there. The flames had died enough so that they could see that it was not destroyed. And so they began to think about things they hadn't thought about for a while. and nobody moved. And then comes the message. There's a radio, a light radio system which flashes Morse code right through space to them. And this is the message that came. Australian continent atomized in premature explosion of atomic stockpile. Los Angeles, London bombed. War. Come home. Come home. Come home. They stood up from their tables. Come home. Come home. Come home. Have you heard from your brother Ted this year? You know, with mail, $5 a letter to Earth, I don't write much. Come home. I've been wondering about Jane. You remember Jane, my kid sister? Come home. At 3 in the chilly morning, the luggage store proprietor glanced up. A lot of people were coming down the street. Stayed open late on purpose. What'll it be, mister? By dawn, the luggage was gone from the shelves. So here is this whole collection of people, most of them Americans, I believe, almost all, perhaps all of them. But that's not the issue. Who had left Earth to avoid atomic catastrophe and for other reasons, and who got there and were well-established, had forgotten Earth, well-established in this new society. The cataclysm that they fled to avoid takes place. The message comes, and it's a very interesting message. Come home. And what do? They go back. And at the middle of the week, and that was the last thing we did, I asked the question, why did they go back? Why did they go back?
Home wasn't there anymore.
That's right. Why did they go back?
Because there were ties.
Ties. What kind of ties are they?
Yeah,
all right. The people. Are you surprised that they went back? When you really think about it, does it surprise you? This is obviously Ray Bradbury creating a story. He's saying, here is what I think happens in that kind of situation. Are you surprised to hear that?
They would only be going back if they had hope that the humans that they were going to see were there. But it sounds like they didn't go out of their way to find out before they went back.
Right, they didn't know.
Dead or alive.
But what did they know?
Someone was there to send a message.
All right, but there was someone there. And as a matter of fact, I think it's quite, I would posit that it's quite deliberate that it's done in that sense, that they don't know, and that what draws them back is ties to the individuals that they've been talking about, that they knew, but that transforms itself into something else. That, you know, that you abstract from that, which is what? A kind of tie to humanity, kind of tie to the ties that people have. Yes?
Do I have much the same or something happening? A lot of people are immigrating to Israel that had really no connection with the land as such. Maybe people of their same kind, and people are going there to spend their later years, and I don't know to what degree, but I know it is happening.
Heard someone explain the other day in one of the little discussions we were having around that maybe it was even in this session explaining that that from his experience as a pastor, well, maybe that was you, as a matter of fact, I can't remember. The bigger the tragedy, the more people came to the funeral.
Yes.
Out of the community, the more a community kind of event it was. That informs this, I think.
He also says they're going back to Israel And certainly there's nothing there in the land, there's nothing there that they want except what? As you say, the ties or something there, because not the country.
Right. And not ties with the people they already have ties to.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, right. In fact, in the case of Israel, most, it's very parallel, most of those ties were destroyed, or a great many of those ties were destroyed by the Holocaust. And that becomes the tragic event that draws, pulls them there. Yeah.
I think we all have a little bit of that tie to our ancestors' home. I mean, if any one of us were to visit Europe, probably the place we'd want to visit most is the land that our ancestors came from.
There's another modern parallel, I think, in terms of the very specific historical example that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was in this country at the, when hostilities broke out, and he very deliberately chose to return to Germany to have a part in that nation's life in order that whatever emerged after the war, he would belong to.
There's another one that's very dramatic. It's just occurred. Poland. That numbers of people, not all the Poles in America, you know, but...
And it's funny, they didn't go back to help Solidarity when it was growing, but when it was being squelched is when they felt they had to get back.
And what they, what drew them, perhaps what drew them back is something, but not knowing, you know, having to be there, having to, what phrase you might, it's hard to put this in words, having to do what you could under the circumstances, right. One of the, we're going to quickly leave this now and jump to the other two books, but just keep in mind the question that it raises about the what this might say about hope, about our hope of, putting it in several terms, of avoiding nuclear catastrophe, or our hope of, or living the politics of hope. Is there something in what we've just, what we see in this novel, in that sort of, that's, it's suicidal, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, as it turns out.
That's what I'm about to say. I think there should have been some of those people that were interested in maintaining the humanity,
that's
rather
right.
than going back to where they're obviously going to die of radiation or whatever.
But that's rational.
Oh. Sorry.
I am. Village.
That's a real point. You're absolutely right. It makes no sense. It makes no sense.
If someone has a death in the family, sometimes maybe they think, well, it's not important that I go back. But usually people are absolutely. Have to go back. It doesn't matter how much it costs. They get on the first plane back to wherever it is, just to be at the home or with the sister, or you know, just to be there where the tragedy has occurred. It's just an overwhelming sort of thing, not necessarily rational.
So often hope rears its head after the fact. That's and in irrational ways. When the people should have perhaps been concerned about the destruction of the earth before the fact. futile gestures like this are kind of romantic, but they're not very effective.
Mm-hmm. That's the challenge. That's the challenge. That's the challenge. Can that be mobilized?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm reading Clowns of God now, and two of the people in there are looking at valleys in the mountains, kind of like Holden, to run away and hide in, you know, and that really draws me. I read a lot of science fiction, and I've got my ideas where I'm going. but that is kind of a hopeless gesture. You know, somehow we need to, instead of saying it's God's will, or that's how Revelation comes to the conclusion. So we need to say at this point now, hope is in saying no, you know, and being willing to work for peace now instead of making the gallant gesture when everything's falling apart.
Yeah. Okay. There's another thought. This hopeless gesture comes to my mind in the context of Gandhi and the approach of nonviolence. When they had waves upon waves upon waves of nonviolent warriors who walked into the salt works and were just systematically clubbed down by British and Indian guards and didn't even raise their hands to fend off the blows, but trying consistently to press forward that we love the British and our Indian brothers. I mean, that sounds like a hopeless, my God, that's not how you fight a battle. But this faith and the power of love to overcome. And then near the end of Gandhi's life, someone said to him, how can you apply nonviolence in the nuclear age? And what would you do if the war broke and the planes were going to drop a nuclear bomb? And his answer was something like this. I would go out, I mean, if this were feasible, I would go outside and look at the plane up there, 30,000 feet, that's about to drop the bomb, and pray for the pilot. I mean, that sounds like, is there hope in that?
One of the things that you may have, in relation to this comment, that you may find interesting is to see Heritage of a Dream by Martin Luther King, that film about Martin Luther King and about the peace movement, the civil rights movement. If you're staying and are going to have the opportunity to see that. Any other quick comments on this piece of it? All right. Now I've really neglected Brave New World as far as discussion during this week, and I'm going to continue to do that today. But let's go back to Brave New World for just a second and focus on a group of people in the novel Brave New World who you can call the deviants, the incorrigibles, the people who would not conform. And in 1984, this is a small group who had to be isolated. And I used a term earlier in the week of almost as if they were insane. It is more than that, however, as I looked back again at Brave New World this week, they're isolated more as if they were animals in a zoo. You know, in a prison, isolated, but allowed, not insane, allowed to live their way. Because if they were isolated in that way, they were not particularly a threat to the rest of the society. But as long as they were loose inside the society, they were something of a threat. These people did strange things, you see. They quoted Shakespeare, for instance. They read Shakespeare. They dressed funny. They did all sorts of things. And the question that you're posed with as you think about Brave New World or look at it again is, you know, what is that contrast? What made them tick as compared to the other? The ones, they wouldn't take the soma. They wouldn't take the happiness pill. What did they call it? The phrase, one of the phrases was a gram is better than a dam. Another one, and the other thing that was encouraged in that society was promiscuous sexual relations. As a a matter of course, and there were phrases about that too. There were slogans all through the book. Well, these are a group of people who wouldn't conform to that. So they formed another kind of community, completely isolated, and in a sense in prison within this world. Well, based on that, what you may remember of the novel, what do you think that's there that makes that tick? What is the significance of that group of people within that very, you know, technologically driven society? This is a society in which there are clones. You know, people are being, well, I shouldn't call them people. Workers are being created on assembly line basis through test tube techniques far beyond what we've been able to do so far, or hopefully ever will. But
they had a freedom to think for one thing, and to do what they wanted.
They had what?
Freedom to think.
Right. They had freedom to think and to do what they wanted to do. There were people who resisted something.
Dehumanization.
All right. And what is the difference between human as they being human and being dehumanized?
Love.
Love, all right.
Individuality.
Mm-hmm.
Individuality.
The reserve, the right to feel pain.
Yes, the right to feel pain. Back to Martian Chronicles for a minute.
Irrationality.
Irrationality. All right, very good. And irrationality manifests itself in real relationships between people, for another thing. Just let that sit there for a few minutes while we look at 1984 and think about that. Now let's go to 1984 very quickly. There's a love affair. It isn't quite right to call it a love affair, between Winston and Julia. And it is, I think, the key to the book. And I just want to read a couple of very brief passages here. Talking about one of the things that Winston and Julia begin a love affair. Well, sexual affair. And it makes them take great risks. They find a room in the proletarian section of London that's a hideaway, both of them knowing that they will be found out, that there's no way that they can keep this as a hiding place. This describes them in the hiding place. Dirty or clean, the room was paradise. As soon as they arrived, they would sprinkle everything with pepper bought on the black market, tear off their clothes and make love with sweating bodies, and fall asleep and wake to find that the bugs had rallied and were massing for the counterattack. 4, 5, 6, 7 times they met during the month of June. Winston had dropped his habit of drinking gin at all hours. He seemed to have lost the need for it. He had grown fatter. His varicose ulcer had subsided, leaving only a brown stain on the skin above his ankle. His fits of coughing in the early morning had stopped. The process of life had ceased to be intolerable, and he no longer had any impulse to make faces at the telescreen or shout curses at the top of his voice. The telescreen is the spy and communication system. Now that they had a secure hiding place, almost a home, it did not seem a hardship that they could only meet infrequently and for a couple of hours at a time. What mattered was that the room over the junk shop should exist. To know that it was there inviolate was almost the same as being in it. The room was a world, a pocket of the past where extinct animals could walk. And then one other brief section. This is Winston thinking about Julia. She's sleeping in the hideaway. He did not suppose, from what he could remember of her, he's thinking of his mother, I'm sorry. Did not suppose, to begin with, he did not suppose from what he could remember of her that she had been an unusual woman, still less an intelligent one. And yet she had possessed a kind of nobility, a kind of purity, simply because the standards that she obeyed were private ones. Her feelings were her own and could not be altered from outside. It would not have occurred to her that an action which is ineffectual thereby becomes meaningless. If you loved someone, you loved him. And when you had nothing else to give, you still gave him love. He's thinking of a time when he took the chocolate bar away from his little sister. Only, I mean, they were practically starving, and he grabbed it. When the last of the chocolate was gone, his mother had clasped the child in her arms. It was no use. It changed nothing. It did not produce more chocolate. It did not avert the child's death or her own, but it seemed natural to her to do it. The refugee woman in the boat had also covered the little boy with her arm, which was no more use against the bullets than a sheet of paper. The terrible thing that the party had done was to persuade you that mere impulses, mere feelings were of no account, while at the same time robbing you of all power over the material world. When once you were in the grip of the party, what you felt or did not feel, what you did or refrained from doing made literally no difference. Whatever happened, you vanished, and neither you nor your actions were ever heard of again. And yet, to the people of only two generations ago, this would not have seemed all important because they were not attempting to alter history. They were governed by private loyalties which they did not question. What mattered were individual relationships, and a completely helpless gesture, an embrace, a tear, a word spoken to a dying man could have value in itself. The Poles, that is the people who were not part of the party, lived in squalid lives in the city and were allowed to do all the things that almost all the things that human beings do. They had to eat once in a while, but you know, they had more life, more like ours. The Poles, it suddenly occurred to him, had remained in this condition. They were not loyal to a party or a country or an idea. They were loyal to one another. Now, the Poles are not the highest order of human beings in the society in terms of rank and position and so on. For the first time in his life, he did not despise the Poles or think of them merely as an inert force which would one day spring to life and regenerate the world. The Poles had stayed human. They had not become hardened inside. They had held on to the primitive emotions which he himself had to return by conscious effort. And in thinking this, he remembered without apparent relevance how a few weeks ago he had seen a severed hand lying on the pavement and had kicked it into the gutter as though it had been a cabbage stalk. The Poles are human beings, he said aloud. We are not human. There's a phrase in there called private loyalties, which in an environment of overwhelming tyrannical statism, which is what 1984 is, become several things. If you think back for a moment to what we just said about both that little passage of the Martian Chronicles and the behavior of those people, and also to Brave New World and these people who were isolates and forced to live among themselves in a zoo-like environment. Private loyalties is a way of describing what we've just been talking about. That is, they are private. They are not something that is imposed on us by, or imposed on these people by a government or a way of life. They are private. And you might even want to substitute another word for private. I'm not sure. And in 1984, what has to happen in order for that society to survive is that systematically the government must break down any private loyalties there are. The great crime that Julia and Winston commit is not to like sex together, not to develop an old-fashioned, out-of-date kind of thing that violates the rules against the way you behave as people in a society, but because what they did was establish private loyalties. And those private loyalties are a threat to the society and must systematically be extinguished. Now remember that Julia and Winston's affair, which was lust at the beginning and turned into a bond that helped them, what it did was to help them defy the society, to take risks. even though they knew the inevitable result. It made it possible for them to, it made it possible for them to commit thought crime and actually act against the state. They in the process, they make a commitment that they feel is significant, one which is not to betray each other, a private tie, a process of loss. That's the only thing. They both know they're going to be brainwashed. They both know that this whole thing is going to fall apart, that they can't possibly stay together. They both know that in the end they will die, because that's what happens to everybody. And they know it because they're part of the system where that happens. But they make a commitment not to betray each other, because that is the ultimate way of defying that pressure and what happens. Huh? They betray each other. Julia has some doubts, I must say, about whether in fact they can keep from betraying each other. And as a matter of fact, after it's all over, after with the rats, if you remember the movie or the book, if the, with the rats running across him, the single thing that he cannot stand, how does he betray it? Hey, Julia. He screams out, do it to Julia. You know, the ultimate betrayal of the private time. Okay, then they meet afterward. You think you're going to have a little trouble finding hope in this? They meet. He did not, I'm going to skip through part of this because it's a little too long. He did not attempt to kiss her, nor did they speak. As they walked back across the gate, she looked directly at him for the first time. It was only a momentary glance, full of contempt and dislike. They sat down. I betrayed you, she said baldly. I betrayed you, he said. She gave him another quick look of dislike. Sometimes, she said, and of course we haven't seen this happen to her, we only saw it happen to Winston. Sometimes, she said, they threaten you with something, something you can't stand up to, can't even think about, and then you say, don't do it to me, do it to somebody else, do it to so-and-so. Is exactly what happened to Winston. And perhaps you might pretend afterwards that it was only a trick and that you just said it to make them stop and didn't really mean it. But that isn't true. At the time when it happens, you do mean it. You think there's no other way of saving yourself and you're quite ready to save yourself that way. You want it to happen to the other person. You don't give a damn what they suffer. All you care about is yourself. And after that, you don't feel disdain toward the other person any longer. There did not seem to be anything more to say. The wind plastered their thin overalls against their bodies. Almost at once it became embarrassing to sit there in silence. Besides, it was too cold to keep still. She said something about catching her tube and stood up to go. We must meet again, he said. Yes, she said. We must meet again. And, of course, you know that they never will. Now, remembering that 1984 is a negative utopia, what you see here is a portrayal of the negative side. It, just as it was, by the way, in Brave New World. I mean, the people in this group were not, they didn't win in the end, I mean, in any sense as far as overthrowing the society or anything of the sort. They were isolated and objects of some ridicule and deliberate, systematic ridicule and so on. Here, too, what happens is that the individual people lose and the tie has to be broken, and it is. They cannot survive it. Why can't they survive it? I mean, well, what's happened? In the novel, by the time they develop this relationship, you know, they hope that it might not be too late, but in their hearts, they kind of know it is. In other words, the ties have been so systematically destroyed that it gets down to ties between one or two people in that society. And you can't then make it. But the bigger tie is gone already in this society. And I would just suggest to you that it is similar, that tie is similar to the one you see in the Martian Chronicles. The universal tie there that sends these people back to face they know not what. And remember, they, of course, weren't positive it was going to end that way. It is the tie that took the emigrants back to Earth in the Martian Chronicles. It is the tie that caused resistance to drugs and escape in Brave New World. It is the tie that brought Winston and Julia together and had to be broken at all costs for the negative utopia of 1984 to survive. We've already said it when we were looking at the Martian Chronicles. It is a sort of human tie. Now, what kind of hope does that suggest? That's the rest of our discussion, and we only, I'm sorry to say, only have 10 minutes and not the half hour I hoped. Yes.
I was thinking, how do you find hope in 1984? I believe the hope is that they can never do that. They cannot break those ties. No state will ever be able to break them.
They're already starting. I think it's already started. In that, think about the military. They move those people so often, they cannot establish ties other than their own little nuclear family. And then you look at corporations that move their people continuously.
Except that, interestingly enough, in the corporations, that's starting to be reversed. People are saying, I'm not going to go just anywhere to further my career. I'm stopping. I'm going to stay here and not get a raise.
Okay. That's a kind of a key thing. I think you're both right.
Yeah.
There's kind of a key thing there. What are the human beings doing in that environment? And I see it in my own corporation. It's happening all the time. They're resisting. And they're resisting when? When are they resisting? While there's still time. Okay. Yes. Does that suggest anything more to you?
They're beginning to hurt.
I was going to say that even if the ties end up being broken, the result will not be a neatly automated society that will produce things and leave these people in power that want to be in power. What it will produce is chaos, anarchy, insanity with which nobody can work, nobody in power. They may break the ties, but the end result will not be anything manageable, and they will not have power. So that the sickness, the disease, the insanity that comes from trying to break these unbreakable ties, the end result will be useless.
Have you got anything, any of you, that tells you that the ties can't be broken or won't be broken? Let's just leave that for a minute.
Our family of six has been scattered all over the country. Following their work. Everybody's retired now, they're all home again. Those ties in 30-40 years weren't broken. I had a comment, I haven't read this, it was a long time ago. But in thinking about hope, a comment that was made yesterday, that our politicians don't have as much power as they used to have. Now that gives me hope.
Yeah. Really.
Against something like this ever happening.
But kind of on the other side, when you're discussing Brave New World, more negative is that there's isolation now. That as they isolated those free thinkers, I think people in our day and age who would be termed, I suppose, counterculture, are isolated from mass society and in smaller groups, and the weight of society bears them down and says what they value, what they think is not realistic, is not valid, is not practical. and that sort of thing. And so I'm afraid that it's that sort of indirect subversion that's going on that will get us in the end, could get us.
All right. We're getting very close. We're getting very close to moving the discussion of this resistance to statism, or whatever that means. Remember, in Brave New World, just as in 1984, it was already too late at this point. That's one of the principles of a negative utopia. The thing had been taken over, so the question becomes the same, you know, the resistance question. You keep it from happening. I'm sitting here now, and I've been thinking back over this week in particular, and the discussions of great concern over thermonuclear holocaust and how you prevent it and how you avoid it. And I'm just curious about whether in what you see, in what we see in these books, whether there are any possible hope suggestions that give you a feeling of hope. I think you've just been talking about some of them.
I think that we have to believe that there is. I mean, if we didn't, I know that I didn't believe that there was hope that we could do something. You know, I don't know if I could survive if I believe that, you know, we can make a difference, that we can keep our humanity and with each other and everything else, that we can resist.
What is that?
There is
you're getting, you're really starting to get there.
I'll let her finish. I don't know, this, I don't want this to sound like a trite answer, but maybe it is. There's a yin and yang between the journey inward and the journey outward. The inward journey, which I sense is sort of reaching God within me, and the outward journey of resistance. And when you were reading that come home, I thought of a song that I can't remember all the words of it, but somehow I must learn when I was a kid. It come home, ye who are weary, come home, home, you know, that kind of thing. But that the tie, the home, is really God, that so there's a universality of our ties, that we could discover the presence of God. If God is present in me, then by extension he's present in all. And that's a beginning to break up some notions that other outside forces have put upon me, that we are us and David is the enemy over here and so forth. I think the movement must be beyond protest. If we're faced with, we still have time, we assume there's still time to stop the nuclear holocaust, but protesting it is not, resisting it is necessary.
Okay, when you make the distinction between protesting and resisting, what are you saying?
Okay. Resistance is somehow throwing a monkey wrench into the machinery. It is more than saying, for example, we don't say tax protest, we say tax resistance. It is that, you know, as a sense is for a person to say, I know that there's a penalty to this, but it's like even breaking the law. Or it's the person who just doesn't say to his employer, oh, I really protest this move to Denver, but I'll go. He just doesn't go.
Okay.
Sure, doesn't make a lot of sense. You think
of living the politics of hope. Think of sex as politics in 1984. Protest politics. You know, much as you could do, it's too late, it's over, and that's the negative side of the utopia. Shakespeare as politics in Brave New World, again, it's there's a certain sense of futility. In the Martian Chronicles, you know, desperate as the situation is, theirs, more desperate than ours, planned survival as a politics, you know, and it's active, it's proactive, not simply reactive. And, you know, those of you who were at Bible study this morning, what would John Schramm say about all this? What would he say?
Discipleship is being an alternative. The idea of Jesus as a different way, of God, the ties, this tie we've been talking about has to do with God, is that being a disciple mostly means resisting being different than the larger society.
Anybody else?
Again, in none of the books is the faith mentioned, much less taken seriously. And I think you can see trends within society that says, you know, that faith is isolated and discounted to a fringe area, you know, of cult. And that if we indeed are political politics of hope, then faith must be for us central. And I'm not very hopeful at that point.
Okay.
Well, I think we have to decide that it's worth paying the price for what Jerry was saying.
I saw that Bible study this morning. We're at the end of our time. I saw that Bible study this morning as saying that Christianity, as it developed, was not a non-worldly alternative, but actually a challenge to the existing status quo. And, you know, I was thinking as I sat there of the parallel between 1984 and the regime that had preceded who was the emperor?
Domitian.
Domitian. Mm-hmm. The horribly repressive, murderous kind of regime. And that if you see this movement, I realize, you know, that I don't know if Jesus is ever mentioned in here except in any of these things, except maybe disparagingly as part of the scene. But if you really look at that, what you really see is those ties being tools that can be used in moving aggressively from some standpoint, which at Holden Village, I presume, would be a Christian politics thrust to make something else happen. It just seems to me that what we see here is a warning that says, doesn't say repent before it's too late. It says move before it's too late. Act. Because when I look at you in all these three books, the creator of these books looks at us, he sees certain things occurring that are terribly destructive. And we see them too. We've been talking about seeing them in the nuclear environment.
Here's an example. I have two friends in Kalamazoo that I just mentioned. One has done a lot of study of the Nazi, the regime, the Third Reich, and so forth in Germany. And he says, consistently, Christian people, when they were confronted with resisting some small step that was being taken in that government, said, well, this isn't big enough yet. There's no sense in risking my job, risking this or risking that. Well, let's wait until the issue really is important, and then we'll throw it on the line. And little by little, they just went down the road. Okay, that's, the other one is a friend of mine who's a director of a manufacturing firm that employs all handicapped people, but they're trying to make it self-sufficient so that they earn their own way, and they get contracts from various other companies. And he's worked with his board on the ethical issues of that, and they had an opportunity. One of the things they had is a packaging, that they make cardboard containers is one of their things they make, and they had the opportunity to take on a contract to make cardboard containers to ship parts of weapons. And they struggled that through, whether and decided not to do it. They could have made quite a bit of money with that one. But where do you draw the line? If we can make the cardboard ship part of a bomb, could we then make part of the bomb, and then could we make, you know, there has to, I think we're always waiting for the big issue where I can really resist something that looks really evil. This is a little bit yet too small to worry about.
Right. Well, if you have the opportunity, if you're interested in going back to these books at some point, do it with Holden Village in mind and living the politics of Holden and see what happens.